You're listening to Panel Borders, the podcast version of Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and this episode, which continues December's Gay Comics Month, is the second of two shows looking at the winners of 2008's Queer Press Grant, which was awarded by Prism Comics and has the aim of nurturing emerging talent from the LGBT community. Both of this year's winners create comics that use and subvert superhero tropes, and in this episode, which is an extended version of the broadcast interview, I'm talking to Justin Hall, the creator of Glamazonia, the Uncanny Super Tranny, which tells the tale of a transgender superheroine who fights mythical creatures, serial killers, and old-fashioned superhero origin stories. This is an uncut interview and includes strong language. First, though, here's a message from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. Resonance FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
I spoke to Tommy yesterday about Pride High, so I thought it might be nice to talk to you as well on the same show since you both shared the grant. I've been working in comics for 7 years now, and you previously won a Zerik Award. I mean, winning the Queer Grant as well, do you find that's raised your profile within the gay community, or it's just nice to have another recognition of your work?
I find that it's been helpful in general. I imagine it'll be more so when I actually get the publication out that I won for, because then I'll be able to slap some kind of insignia on the cover and say, you know, this was the winner of the Queer Press Grant. Unfortunately, I don't think that there's a lot of the publicity doesn't get out to a wider portion of the comics reading population. So I'd like to, I'll capitalize on that when it actually gets published, when I can print it.
Looking at the gay comic scene in America from this side of the Atlantic, I guess I'd romanticize that it was a lot larger than it actually is because of the presence of people like Prism. But presumably it's actually quite hard to get gay comic books distributed in America.
It is definitely an underground, though there are increasingly more and more kind of what I would call kind of crossover creators that are working in mainstream comics, and certainly kind of queer themes are showing up more in the mainstream American comics, with even with straight writers such as Greg Rucka or Neil Gaiman, or people that have no problem using queer themes. The kind of independent or underground queer comics field is still pretty underground. Prism has been amazing. It's been a wonderful organization that's really developed this underground, but it's not the only one out there. I mean, there's also more retailers, for example, that are either queer or queer friendly. That's been helping a lot. Also things like the panels that happen at the different comic book conventions, such as in San Diego, and I run a queer cartoonist panel at the Alternative Press Expo, which is the kind of largest of the independent comic conventions. So that kind of stuff definitely breathes more life into and more recognition of this kind of queer cartooning scene. I also curated a museum show of queer cartoonists at the Cartoon Art Museum here in San Francisco, which was the first time that I think something that at that level of publicity happened around queer cartooning, which was nice. But there's also other people like Jennifer Camper, I think, did a gallery show along the same lines in New York. So there's people doing the work. And as you start kind of getting more and more involved with this stuff, like, as I've been, I'm constantly looking for new creators to get on my panel, for example, and you start realizing the kind of depth and kind of breadth of the different queer creators out there. A lot of them don't necessarily know, but have a lot of venues for distribution and publication, as you mentioned. But there are creators out there making work, and as you kind of dig a little bit, you realize how kind of the potential size of this scene.
I mean, when it came to creating Glamazonia, was that a character that you specifically made for the Prism guide that comes out every year, or had it pre-existed?
It actually pre-existed. The first The first stuff that I was doing was a little bit darker and headier. I did this thing called a Sacred Text, kind of fantastical retelling of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And that's what I got the Zerik for. And then I did this True Travel Tales series. And so Glamazonia was, I actually started fairly early. It's probably like my second year of making comics. And I just wanted something a little bit more fun and goofy that I could make in conjunction with this kind of darker and headier stuff and more autobiographical stuff. So she was kind of a minor side project. For years, I would do kind of one-page strips of hers, and I put that up on the GLA, the Gay League of America website. And then she kept on getting more popular. She developed a certain amount of popularity. I didn't realize, I kind of had thought that she wasn't really going to go very far in the sense that, here's a character who is essentially poking fun at queer, purity and queer culture and, superhero culture, which, the crossover there, that someone who's going to get the jokes, aimed at both, superhero comics and superhero fandom and, queer culture stuff, it seems fairly small to me, but the reality is, for some reason, is she kind of sparked imagination of us, probably more than the rest of my creation, so, she wound up with kind of the cover of the Bay Guardian here in San Francisco, and then finally, I was like, all right, I need to collect all the various stories I've done. I also started putting four-page faux origin stories of her in every one of the Prism guide books that come out every year, their annual books, so that developed a certain amount of material as well, and so I finally collected all that material into one mini-comic, and then now I'm developing an actual full-color book, which I'll use the press grant for.
Okay. I mean, what was
so she kind of developed organically, I guess. It's been a long time in coming, basically.
I mean, what was the original genesis of the character? Was it reading superhero characters like Wonder Woman and thinking they're pretty butch anyway, perhaps it could be a transgendered character? Or was it perhaps someone you met on a pride march that inspired it?
Well, there's actually this interesting kind of drag scene here in San Francisco that's characterized. There was a long-running drag show called Tranny Shack that ran at the Stud in San Francisco for about 12 years. It actually just ended a few months back, actually. And San Francisco really kind of gave birth to this other form of drag, where drag is not as, kind of doing traditional diva impersonations and, Judy Garland numbers, but rather drag is a kind of performance art, basically, where you have, these kind of, this new wave of drag queens who weren't afraid to be kind of, ugly and grotesque and kind of, do, covers of, a Nine Inch Nails song or a White Stripes song and give birth on stage. And so it was a really kind of it's been a real kind of exciting artistic movement in San Francisco. And to a certain extent, Glamazonia came out of that, me going to Tranny Shack shows and going, okay, well, there's a bit of a confusion because this particular artistic scene in San Francisco uses the word tranny, they say Tranny Shack, and it's not really, it's usually more drag than actual transgendered, but things are, gender is, and gender play is very fluid in San Francisco. There's a lot of, it's probably the center of transsexual movement here in the United States. For sure it is. But it's also a real center for drag. And there's a kind of interplay between all of this stuff, a kind of gender fluidity, which is really kind of neat. So when I realized that Glamazonia was, in fact, not a drag queen, but rather a transgendered woman, but who is also very campy, like she's not someone who's trying to pass, but she's more along the lines of, like the Lady Boys of Thailand or something, where they have this, they come out of queer culture, they're very campy, and they have a identify themselves as queer, but they're not gay men, and they're not drag queens. So that's kind of where she evolved into. So it's been a bit of an identity process. I certainly don't ever want to insult transsexual people who are just trying to pass and have no interest in this kind of camp identity. But Glamazonia as a character is very much about queer culture and about campiness. So I would say she developed as a reaction to this very specific kind of performance scene in San Francisco, and then also as a response to superhero fandom, which I have a kind of love-hate relationship with, which I think is true for most independent creators, comics creators in America, because as you know, the American comic book market is 80-90% controlled by dominated by superheroes, which is just bizarre. I mean, it doesn't exist in any other country on the planet, and it, you know, no other art form is completely dominated by this one bizarre little genre. And it's incredibly infuriating for someone like me who's interested in making autobiographical stories and, you know, historical fiction and travel narratives and all these other things that in any other medium would be considered fairly mainstream types of narratives, but in American comics are considered underground or alternative simply because they don't have muscular men running around and shooting laser beams from their eyeballs in tights. You know, but of course I still love them because I grew up reading superheroes, and you know, as much as I kind of might at times try to look down my nose at them, I also of course end up buying a lot of superhero comics and love them. You know, it's and certainly as a gay man, it's, you know, it's okay to have muscular men running around in tights sometimes. Glamazonia ends up being also a response to the superhero fandom, where my ridiculing it because it takes itself so completely seriously, and it's, you know, it's inherently ridiculous, but at the same time a kind of loving homage to it, because I part of me will always love it as well. So I think she kind of reflects my kind of love-hate relationship with superheroes as well.
Mm. Well, and it's interesting that the gay characters that they've had in mainstream superheroes of late, characters in like Young Avengers and Runaways, have also had fluid gender identities rather than being traditional gay characters. I wonder if it's because of the whole nature of the secret identity and whether you're an alien or a god or whatever as a superhero that sort of blends in with that.
Well, I mean, the reality is that superheroes as a kind of, construct, and superheroes are inherently really pretty gay.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, let's face it. I mean, I actually wrote a paper a few years ago that I presented at the San Diego Comic Con on transgendered characters in comics, and it was called Heroes Wear Tights. And it's, you know, this idea that, I mean, literally this kind of costume play where you're creating a separate identity for yourself in these kind of, you know, in these tights and stuff. It's really inherently kind of gay. And there's a whole idea that you would have this kind of superpowered identity that would come out in certain times and other people wouldn't know about. You'd have your mild-mannered side, and you'd have your kind of, you know, super-powered crazy side. I think it really speaks to queer audiences. So, you know, I don't know if that was what the initial creators of the superhero archetype really thought of it as, but I think it fits really, really well into queer self-identity. I don't think it's an accident that we tend to relate so much to superheroes, you know, especially when you also start adding the extra, you know, like with the X-Men or something, where their powers develop at puberty, and, you know, they're, you know, an oppressed minority who is, you know, persecuted and people don't understand them, and but they're really special, you know, and they're beautiful. I think you're right. There definitely is this kind of identification with queers and superheroes. You also have to, you know, remember that historically, superheroes were created by an oppressed minority group in the United States. Mm. They were virtually entirely a creation of first and second generation Jews,
yeah,
in New York City. So they were essentially kind of all about, you know, in some kind of subconscious way, I think, all about, you know, a struggle for power and acceptance in a dominant culture that didn't accept them.
Well, and the fact that the first superhero comics coincided with the Second World War as Jews were being exterminated in Europe, created an alter ego in America where they could fight back.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and but still hiding who they were. I mean, you know, Superman's not an Aryan, but, you know, he kind of has kind of wound up. I mean, I think most people don't kind of see that. And even, like, you know, probably the first openly Jewish superhero was The Thing in Fantastic Four, but it took him hundreds of issues before he was actually able to officially come out, even though it was clear to people who knew who he was, you know, what neighborhood he came from. He came from Jack Kirby's neighborhood. But, you know, I think there are a lot of parallels there. And certainly, you know, there have been kind of queer, you know, more, you know, certainly with the kid sidekicks, for example, you know, there's a lot of, like, queer stuff to that. I mean, I actually kind of agree more with Michael Chabon, who you know, wrote that Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay.
Mm.
He was, you know, suggesting that he's got a gay character there, and he certainly acknowledges that there's this, you know, homoeroticism with the kid sidekicks, but he has the character talk about how really what it was a father fixation, that, you know, you're talking about a generation coming out of World War II of kids whose fathers were completely absent, and they were desperate for father figures. And, you know, a lot of these sidekicks were orphans who then, you know, hook up with this very much a father figure. And, of course, there's eroticism to that as well, but I think a lot of it is really about searching for a father figure.
Mm.
Or daddy. That's really what it pulled out of. But yeah, I think it's no great surprise that superheroes and queers kind of, there's a lot of identification there.
Well, I suppose also the nature of so many superheroes being orphans, and in the gay community, people construct new families from the community and the friends they make. I mean, it's interesting that in the origin story for Glamazonia, you're making fun of the Superman story, which, you know, uses all of those tropes and archetypes.
I actually have, maybe different origin stories for her now.
Oh, okay.
So
it's like the Joker in the new Batman film.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she basically comes up with a different origin story depending on who she's telling it to. So, but each one is a parody of another. You know, so I've got a Batman parody origin story. I've got a Superman parody origin story. A Spider-Man one. I'm actually drawing up an Iron Man one, which is the Iron Tranny.
Excellent.
But basically, yeah. So she, she's pretty fluid with her identity, and she, still sidle up to whomever she needs to and tell whatever origin story she thinks is gonna work for her at that moment.
Thinking of the other comics that you've done, Stripped and the story that you had in the book of Boy Trouble, were they also autobiographical comics like the True Travels Tales?
Yeah, the first Boy Trouble book that I was in, I did an autobiographical story about being in on a boat in the Peruvian Amazon,
mm-hmm.
and meeting a young gay Indian boy on the boat, and that was definitely autobiographical. The second Boy Trouble that just came, the book of Boy Trouble that just came out recently, the last couple of months, that is a biographical story of a friend of mine who is a fetish escort in New York, and he was hired by a John who really wanted to watch Batman and Robin fuck. So he hired my friend and his boyfriend at the time to dress up like Batman and Robin. They had to break into the guy's apartment, and they had a script and everything, you know. And he was dressed up as a supervillain named Evil Bear Man. And he sprayed them with his evil bear musk, which paralyzed them and then inflamed them with lust.
Oh, my God.
It's just one of those, you know, just amazing stories that I was so excited to draw. It was really fun. but I really like doing autobiographical and biographical stories because, for a couple of reasons. There's one, it gives a narrative certain weight and power when you know it's kind of true. So, for example, if you meet someone at a party who comes running up to you and says, "Oh my God, the most amazing thing just happened to me on my way here," that piques your interest a lot more than, "Oh my God, I just thought of something that could have happened to me on the way here." You know? So there's something about kind of truth, quote unquote, that we're drawn to. And then also having to come up with plots on my own. So, you know, I oftentimes when I'm doing fictional stuff, Glamazonia less so because I can just be completely fantastical. I'm not trying to be realistic. But when I'm coming up with more realistic fictional narratives, I'm constantly worried that it sounds too outrageous. And then, so I'm constantly toning everything down. And when I'm actually doing a true story, I know that I can just tell the story and I don't have to worry about it being too crazy because it really happened that way. So in a way, my true stuff, my autobiographical and biographical stuff, tends to be kind of wackier than my fictional stuff, because I've given myself kind of carte blanche to do the crazy stories when I know they're quote-unquote true.
But, I mean, it's interesting, the whole nature of, you know, being stranger than fiction. Because it is the kind of the gap between what is perceived of as the mainstream in comics and what is glamorized by the media, which is superhero comics. Because you've been published in Best American Comics 2006 for one of your autobiographical comics. And yet, I believe that in the current volume, Best American Comics 2008, DC wouldn't give them permission to reprint a Batman story. So they're just, it's almost like there can't be any dialogue between the two kinds of comic creation.
Yeah, it's definitely a real problem. It's funny, I was just talking to Patty about this. It's definitely a problem that there ends up being these kind of at least two distinct worlds within the comic book community in the United States because of just the kind of historical, you know, the way the history is played out of the art form here, where, you know, you have this kind of world of the superheroes and you've got kind of everything else, and the superheroes just don't mix. What we're seeing now is increasingly creators moving back and forth. So you have, an Ed Brubaker who is writing a noir crime comic, but he's also writing the X-Men. I think we're going to see that more and more, where, the big two, you know, DC and Marvel, they realize that the industry is changing, and the big kind of growth market is now in the bookstores. And the bookstore market is less interested in superheroes and more going to be interested in other kinds of material, other kinds of narratives. So, you know, DC, for example, under their Vertigo imprint, is really actively looking for non-superhero graphic novels, you know, that they can put a spine on and they can shelve in Borders, you know, and gain access to a whole other market that way. So I think we're going to see more and more of those divisions breaking down, but absolutely, traditionally that's very much been the case. There's a definite division between the superhero material and their creators, and the kind of more independent stuff and their creators. It's kind of unfortunate. I mean, but I think, again, I think some of the stuff is going to be breaking down a bit in the future. We'll have to see. You know, I'd love to straddle it a little bit. I mean, like I said, I have this kind of love-hate relationship with superheroes, and I'd love to write a Wonder Woman story. But the thing is, I look at, like Tommy is kind of amazing because he takes it very seriously. I mean, he takes the whole kind of genre very seriously. Writing a straight-up superhero story that isn't ironic or, poking fun at it or anything like that. It is what it is, and it's very loving, you know. And I really respect and admire that. I would love to write a Wonder Woman story, but I think if I wrote Wonder Woman for too long, I would feel this incredible itch to make her a lesbian. Like, how could I not make her come out as a lesbian? Because she's so obviously a dyke, you know. So at a certain point, you kind of run up against an editorial wall with these, pre-established superhero characters, and the whole concept of the superhero, which is kind of inherently absurd, these kind of brightly clad, characters running around and being vigilantes, and it's just weird.
Which comics did you find inspirational when you were growing up? Was it a mixture of superhero comics and the more indie stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly initially it was all superhero stuff because that was what was available in the United States. So, though I should say, actually, I grew up in Tintin as well. So I had a steady diet of Tintin and Asterix, which is, harder to find in the United States. We tend to be very, very good at exporting culture, but terrible at importing it. And you see that in the comic book, and in general, but you definitely see that in comic book industry. So
unless Hollywood sniffs a remake.
Right, exactly. Right. It's Hollywood just the remake of the popular thing, something that's popular in another country, instead of just importing it. And you see that in comic books for sure. I mean, Tintin is such a recognizable character to virtually anyone in the world, except for Americans, So, but I, was lucky enough to, my mom used to live in France and stuff, so I was able to have access to some of this material. So I read Tintin and Asterix, and it was definitely important to me. And then I grew up, I loved Jack Kirby's work. I was obsessed with his stuff from very early on. I mean, he's, the real kind of genius of American superhero comics. If it wasn't for Jack Kirby, he's the kind of backbone of it all, in a sense. And then as I got older and the kind of alternative scene started developing, I was definitely, enthralled with, Love and Rockets. I think one of the arguably the greatest American comic ever made, if you look at the whole, course of it, the whole oeuvre. I was never that into the, Archie or Disney stuff. Even as a little kid, never really grabbed me too much. I would say that what I just mentioned would be the one.
Cool. Well, it's interesting because Love and Rockets as well is one title that straddles the gay, straight, the superhero, non-superhero, the autobiographical, fantastical divide and manages to do so with aplomb.
Yeah, that's true. That's a really good point. It's not one thing. I mean, it's very independent in the sense that it has this very distinctive voice, and it's never interested in any kind of editorial wall. it's not trying to create itself for a given market, or it's simply the creator's kind of taking whatever narrative direction they feel like it, and it's amazing how, you're right, how many boundaries it crosses, because it's at some point in its 30-year run, it's been everything, every kind of narrative. Yeah, absolutely. And I find that kind of experimental nature incredibly inspiring and refreshing. And that's one of the things I love about it, is you're never quite sure what's going to be in that comic when you get it. I think recently this last issue that Jaime has been doing a lot of superhero stuff, which has been really actually wonderful to see. It's cool to see it.
So the graphic novel version of Glamazonia, when do you think that might be hitting the shelves?
Definitely, it's going to be out next year.
Okay.
I'm going to try to. I'd love to have it for WonderCon, but I doubt it. I'm actually working with a couple of other illustrators for the first time. So I've illustrated other people's work, but I've never had other people illustrate my work. And ultimately, I'm an okay illustrator with enough work. I'm getting better. With enough work, I could be maybe good, but I'm never going to be a great illustrator. It's just not. I'm not built for it. I think I have more potential as a writer. So ideally, in the future, I'd love to always illustrate at least some of my own material, especially the kind of slice of life stuff. I think that's the stuff I have better handle on. But I would love to work with other illustrators more and more, especially on more fantastical scripts. Like, I've written science fiction scripts and stuff like that. I just can't handle the illustration on that. So anyways, with Glamazonia, I've got two different illustrators that I'm working with on this book. So I'm kind of waiting on them. It's going to depend on them. So that's always the drama when you're working with other people. So we'll see. Hopefully it'll turn out. But I'm I'd love for it to be WonderCon. I'm more likely San Diego.
Cool. Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking to us.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You can find more info about Justin's comics at www.prismcomics.org and on my blog at www.panelborders.wordpress.com. If you live in London or are planning to visit during the next week, London Underground Comics are holding an exhibition of artwork at the Alphabet Bar in Beak Street in Soho, which starts at lunchtime on the 13th of December with a mini small press comics convention and DJs supplying a soundtrack to the pictures, and continues until the 20th. For more info about that, please go to www.londonundergroundcomics.com. Thanks for listening.